Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your guide to everything new and noteworthy in the world of food and cooking. I'm your host, Kara Rota. We are so honored to be joined today by Barbara Lynch, world-renowned chef and restaurateur and the author of the amazing new book, Out of Line, A Life of Playing with Fire. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about Boston first, and specifically Southie, because the sense of place is such an important part of both your book and your incredibly seven celebrated restaurants, three of which are in South Boston. What has Boston meant to you, and how do you think it's influenced your work to be from there and to stay there?
The Fighting Irish, right? South Boston. It means a lot, I guess. Why I stayed in Boston, first of all, I think, as I was opening restaurants, I felt like Boston was missing a lot of what I wanted. We didn't really have an oyster bar or a butcher shop. Well, we did, but it was like butcher shops. You had to go to the North End for certain cuts of meat, or Brookline, really, for other cuts. So, but it was time. I mean, I just felt like there were niches to be filled, and that's what I wanted. I wanted to fill them.
Each of your restaurants really has its own culinary narrative, from Sportello, which sort of reimagines the diner as an Italian trattoria, to the Menton's tasting menu with courses in the double digits. Where do you start when you're designing a restaurant concept, and how specific of an idea do you have about who the audience is for a particular restaurant? Who do you think that you want to eat at your places?
Well, I think I was hoping not just Boston in general for customers. I felt like if you limit yourself to just the neighborhood, then I'll never last. Neighborhoods change, especially in Boston. You know, like Beacon Hill, you might have, like, for Number 9, for instance, is almost 20 years old. And if I considered that a neighborhood joint restaurant, I wouldn't be here for 20 years. Once the kids are off to college, they all, you know, it changes. And really, they actually moved down to the South End once the kids were gone. So I'm feeding them, you know, at B&G and the butcher shop now. And then a new style of customers come in to Beacon Hill. So I wanted all the restaurants to be really more international or national than just neighborhood. And really, all the restaurants are, like, nostalgic for me. And that's where the design came from. And I have the same architect and designer team that I've known for 30 years.
Can you say more about the nostalgia? I feel like that's such an interesting word, because restaurants really are this sort of experience. They're a world. You walk in and you can be transported. Why did you want to achieve that, and how do you think you have?
So based on memory, really, like Sportello is the counter, and it's from my years of working at Brigham's on Park Street from when I was like 15. The cook would never show up. I was a server. Cooks would never show up. The management would never show up. And so here I am, like, serving, pouring tea, flipping grilled cheeses, going to make ice cream sundaes and cashing them out. But it was a formula. The way that was built, these little pods, counters, worked for me. It was like, oh, my God, I was making cash. So that's the way Sportello was built. Butcher shop. It was based on the first trip I ever went to, which is Italy. And I'd go to this bodega where I went to a wild boar butchering. You could buy your meats. You could fill up wine bottles, white or red, get your gas, buy cigarettes, have a shot of Insanto, go to the market. I'm like, wow, this is so cool. Why can't everybody have this? B&G Oysters is like my memory from Kelly's Landing in Southie, where we would get fried clam plate and fried scallops and chowder on Fridays, if we hit the lottery. And then Montan is like my later memories of traveling to France and three Michelin star restaurants for lunch. So yeah, they, and Number 9 is my memories of the St. Botolph Club when I worked there. So, yeah, and there are restaurants that are doable. Like, I knew I could handle them. They're not gigantic, 250 seats. They're more like 60, 65
seats. Sort of an autobiography through restaurants. which is really interesting. You were the second woman to be awarded the James Beard Outstanding Restaurateur Award in 2014, which is pretty amazing,
Pretty crazy, right?
We've been hearing more, I think, in the past few years about some of the issues that female chefs have faced in the restaurant industry, from harassment to underrepresentation to often having to be twice as good to be taken half as seriously. But as a chef and also a restaurateur, you've reached the top of your field in not one, but actually two major roles in this industry. How do you navigate controlling the world of the kitchen versus the world of the restaurant business? And at what point in your career did you decide, I really want to run these things?
Well, after I tried to get pushed out twice in my own restaurant. You know, it's funny when, you know, you hire a COO, or actually, you know, an operations manager then wants to become president and president of a company. And I'm like, oh, my God, president of a restaurant group is kind of odd. Okay. Is it the ego? You know, you go through all this these processes in your head and then he wants to become, he wants to make you CEO and then founder. And then a couple of months later, you get these like emails, the dilemma of a founder. And I'm like, oh, here we go, you know. And they feel like they're smarter than you. And you know, it's just a jargon, it's a lingo. And it's what I feel is that. It was a real disrespect, actually, to me, feeling that I'm not smart enough. I didn't go to Darden, and I didn't go to West Point. Yet, I've been a chef for 30 years, and to me, restaurants are natural. I know how to run them. I know how to cook. And this person didn't. But yet, you think you can run these companies? And you can't even make three of these, you know, this... I was dormant for 7 years. I've never been dormant for 7 years while he was running them. So what made me want to do it? Well, so this was the second one of my managers that tried to push me out of my own company. And this is the last time. And it's you have to go deep with inside yourself and say, oh, my God, I can do this. And be strong about it. You can do it. But you have to let stuff go, too. You have to be able to really delegate and be stronger in saying, you know, delegating in the kitchen and be stronger of what you want and be more organized in what I want in the food. And then be stronger on the outside in terms of what I want for business and what decisions I want to make. And find the right person and keep the right people that are on your side to run it and grow with you.
If you're stuck for ideas on how to develop your logo, website, or business cards, turn to creative minds from around the world via DesignCrowd. DesignCrowd is a website that helps businesses crowdsource custom graphics from over 500,000 designers worldwide. From social media graphics to flyers, menus, packaging, and even t-shirts, DesignCrowd lets you get the perfect custom design every time or your money back. Instead of paying expensive fees and waiting weeks for an agency to pitch an idea, you can get exactly what you need within just 3 days. Simply post a brief describing the design you need, and within hours, you'll receive your first design to review. Then, once you've selected your favorite design, you'll be sent all the files you need to update your branding. It's that easy. And now, Clever Cookster listeners can receive up to $100 off their design project by going to designcrowd.com/clever. That's DesignCrowd.com/clever for a special $100 VIP offer for our listeners. Or simply enter the discount code CLEVER when posting a project on DesignCrowd. And now, back to our podcast. I'm going to ask you a question. I want to preface it by saying I think this is a question that men never get asked, but how did you build that confidence? You had sort of not necessarily a background that many business people have. Right. You had sort of a story that was a little bit all over the place and navigated your way to this in a way that maybe didn't always give you the degrees and the name brands that many people have when they become the boss of their own company. Right. So how did you build that confidence? How did you learn when to push back and how to navigate situations when people were not giving you the respect that you deserved?
Well, I think it takes years to do it. I think part of writing this memoir, actually, there's a lot of triggers. There's a lot of triggers growing up of not being heard. And I think there's a lot of individuals that know what my triggers were. And there comes a point where you're like, oh my God, I'm over it. I need to be heard. I have a voice. And so to build the confidence back up, it's not about screaming and swearing and being tough. It's about elegant etiquette and sort of like coming around from the sides and then go in for the kill is my method, right? Be really nice and gentle and go for the kill and prove to them in a kind way. Don't worry about me. We're going to be all right. I can fix this. And just sit back and watch, you know? Have a nice life. We got this.
What was the process like of writing this book and putting it out into the world? It is so personal. And it's also, I think, really relevant to a lot of people who have been so inspired by your work and your story. What's the feedback been like? And, you know, when you were writing it, did it feel like, wow, so many people are going to read this? Or did you have to kind of...
No, I did the typical, I think, Barbara Lynch thing. Don't think about it. Like,
right.
I kind of thought about it as like, oh, I'm just keeping a journal. I think the toughest part really has been on the tour, because it is emotional, really. And it's just dawning on me now that, like, oh, my God, this world is a really big world, and millions and millions and millions of people are reading it. And, you know, I think the most important part is that it's inspirational. The funny thing is that my colleagues and chefs around the world really think they know me. Of the chef. They know the chef, me. They don't know the real me, the mom me, that I have a heart and I'm really a nice person. Everyone thinks I'm really, really tough, and I'm not. I'm really a softie.
So you have a daughter, and what's it been like to sort of watch her come into her own, and what kind of examples do you want to set for her, both in terms of food philosophy and also business?
The food philosophy part, I think she has down. I mean, she can cook. She knows where she's going to find me. It's usually in the kitchen. You know, we go fishing. She's all over that. But as a woman, eventually, you know, I want her to be a strong woman, a strong leader, an independent person. I want her to be original. I don't want her to be a follower, and I don't see that happening in her life, really. I just want her to see a lot more in the world than I ever did. And I want her to be who she wants to be.
How would you describe your food philosophy and approach? I think a lot of chefs sort of do one kind of food, but all of your restaurants, as we've talked about, really have their own inspirations, their own culinary dialect. So is there sort of an overarching philosophy that drives you or that makes you interested in cooking different kinds of things?
I mean, I think my cuisine is really... French and Italian, really. I would say it's like sort of like French and European, French and Italian, but with my twist on it. I really like good food. I just really like simple food. Like, I'm not like the molecular girl or the nomad plating, and I kind of like really good food. Just beautiful bowl of really good chicken soup would be great, you know? I hope we go back to that, like the basics and like just not all the, although it's beautiful to look at, it's art, that's gorgeous. But you know, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, like I think there's a preciousness, right? There's this sort of like fetishization of something for being so much itself that sort of disregards really the quality and the experience of taste. And is it good? Is it delicious? That's like, always what it should be about.
Like a rainy night or a misty night, chili bowl of steamed potatoes and extra virgin olive oil and like creamed leeks and a glass of like burgundy.
That's very European, I feel like. Well, like that's sort of that simplicity, yeah, but also elegance.
But you can, you know, you hear the rain, you smell it, and oh my God, and you're damp, and you eat that, and it's heaven. That's simple, right?
Absolutely.
There you go.
Barbara, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's really an honor.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Check out the book. It's amazing. Out of Line, A Life of Playing with Fire. And tune in next time on The Clever Cookster, your guide to everything new and noteworthy in the world of food and cooking.